Cassette 8, Side 2.
Chapter 56. Sout. When Jillian called to ask that he talk to Crydike, his first thought had been to rebel over the workload.
I know, her tiny simulacrum had agreed. But you're the only one I can spare who has the qualifications. Let's rephrase that. You are the only one for the job. Crydike is clearly aware and alert, but he can't talk. We need someone to help him communicate through parts of his brain that weren't damaged. You're our expert.
Sout had never really liked Crydike, and the type of injury the captain had suffered made Sout feel queasy. Still, the challenge appealed to his vanity.
What about Charles Start? He's been driving Toshio and me until our flukes droop, and he has top priority on this line.
In the small holo image, Jillian looked very tired.
Not anymore, he doesn't. We're sending out a new probe with Dakota Jim and Metz, one he'll be able to control himself by comlink. Until then, his project takes last place. Last place. Is that understood?
Sout clapped his jaw loudly in assent. It felt good to hear decisive leadership again. The fact that the voice was that of a human he respected helped, too.
This bit about Metz and Takata Jim. I've filled in Toshio, Jillian said. He'll brief you when the chance comes. He is in absolute charge now. You're to obey him with alacrity. Is that clear?
Jillian never lost her vocabulary under pressure. Sout liked that.
Yes, eminently. Now about these resonances I'm getting from the planet's crust. What shall I do? They are, to my knowledge, totally unprecedented. Can you spare someone to do a library search for me?
Jillian frowned.
You say resonances of apparent intelligent origin are coming from deep in Kithrop's crust? Exactly.
Jillian rolled her eyes.
Ifni, to explore this world in peace and quiet would demand a decade of work by a dozen survey ships.
She shook her head.
No, my quick guess is that some formation of probability-sensitive rock below the surface is resonating with emanations from the battle overhead. In any event, it comes after the other priorities, security, the Kikwi, and talking to Crydike. You've got a mouthful to deal with already.
Sout stifled a protest. Complaining would only get Jillian to order him explicitly away from the probe. She hadn't yet, so it would be best to stay quiet.
Now think about your options, Jillian reminded him.
If Streaker makes a break for it, we'll try to get the skiff out to pick up Tom and whoever wants to join us from the island. You can choose to come along, or stay with Metz and Takata Jim and wait it out in the longboat. Inform Toshio of your decision.
I understand. I'll think about it.
Somehow the issue seemed less urgent than it would have a few days ago. The sounds from below were having an effect on him.
If I stay, I still wish you all the best of luck, he added. You too, Melfin,
Jillian smiled.
You're a strange duck, but if I get home, I'm going to recommend you get lots of grandchildren.
Her image vanished as she broke the connection. Sout stared at the blank screen. The compliment, wholly unexpected, left him momentarily stunned. Then a few Kikwi, who were foraging nearby, were surprised to see a large dolphin rise up onto his tail and dance about the small pool. To be noticed by a humpback, to be credited at last for being me.
Chapter 57. Denny and Toshio.
I'm afraid.
Almost without a thought, Toshio put his arm around Denny's shoulder. He gave her a reassuring squeeze.
What for? There's nothing to be scared of.
Denny looked up from the pounding breakers to see if he was serious. Then she realized she was being teased. She stuck out her tongue at him. Toshio inhaled deeply and was content. It wasn't clear to him where his new relationship with Denny was going. It wasn't physical, for one thing. They had slept together last night, but fully clothed. Toshio had thought it would be frustrating, and it was, sort of, but not as much as he had expected. It would work out, one way or another. Right now, Denny needed someone to be nearby. It was satisfying just filling that need. Maybe, when all this was over, she would go back to thinking of him as a boy, 4 years her junior. Somehow he doubted it. She was touching him more now, rather than less, holding his arm and punching him in mock anger, even as memories from the Psi Bomb episode faded.
"When are they supposed to get here with the longboat?"
She looked back over the ocean once more. "Late tomorrow sometime," he answered.
"Takata, Jim, and Metz wanted to negotiate with the ETs. What's to stop them if they decide to ignore orders and try anyway?"
"Jillian's giving them only enough power to get here. They have a regenerator, so they'll be able to charge up for space travel in a month or so. By then, Streaker'd be gone one way or another."
Denny shivered. Toshio cursed his awkward tongue.
"Takata Jim won't have a radio. I'm to guard ours until the skiff comes to pick us up. Besides, what could he offer the Galactics? He won't have any of the charts marking the derelict fleet."
"My guess is he and Metz will wait until everybody leaves, then scuttle off to Earth with Metz's tapes and a hold full of gripes."
Denny looked up at the first stars of the long Kithrop twilight.
"Are you going back?" she asked.
"Streaker's my ship. Thank God Krydike is still alive, but even if he's not skipper anymore, I owe it to him to keep on, as one of his officers should."
Denny glanced up at him briefly, then nodded and looked back out at the sea.
"She's thinking we haven't a chance," Toshio realized. "And maybe we don't. Wearing a Thenanin battle wagon as a disguise, we'll have all the maneuverability of a Calathian mud gleaner. And even fooling the Galactics might not be so good an idea. They want to capture Streaker, but they won't hold back their fire if they see a defeated enemy climbing back up for another round. There still have to be Thenanin around if this scheme is to work. But we can't just sit here waiting, can we? If we do, the Galactics will learn that they can push Earthlings around. We just can't afford to let anyone profit from chasing one of our survey ships."
Toshio changed the subject.
"How's your report coming?"
"Oh, all right, I guess. It's clear the Kikwi are fully presentient. They've been fallow a very long time. In fact, some Darwinist heretics might think they were just getting ripe to bootstrap themselves. They show signs."
Some iconoclast humans still pushed the idea that a pre-sentient race could make the leap to spacefaring intelligence by evolution alone, without the intervention of a patron. Most Galactics thought the idea absurd and strange, but the failure to find humanity's missing benefactor had regained the theory a few adherents.
"What about the metal mound?"
Toshio asked about Denny's other research, begun at Charlie Dart's behest when the chimp had been given top priority, but pursued now out of interest. Denny shrugged.
"Oh, the mound's alive. The professional biologist in me would give her left arm to be able to stay a year on this island with full laboratory equipment. The metal-eating pseudo-coral, the drill tree, the living core of the island, are all symbiots. In effect, they're organs in one giant entity. If I could only write it up at home, I'd be famous if anyone believed me."
"They'll believe you," Toshio assured her. "And you'll be famous."
He motioned that they should start heading back to camp. They only had a little time after second supper to walk and talk. Now that he was in command, he had to make sure that timetables were kept.
Denny held his arm as they turned to return to the encampment. Over the rushing rustle of the wind through the foliage came the intermittent squeaks of the natives, rousing from their siesta to prepare for the evening hunt. They walked in silence along the narrow trail. Chapter 58 Galactics. Krat licked slowly at her mating claw, studiously ignoring the creatures who scurried to clean up the bloody mess in the corner. There would be trouble over this. The Pelan High Council would protest. Of course, she was within her rights, as Grand Admiral, to deal with any member of the fleet as she saw fit. But that did not traditionally cover the skewering of a senior librarian, simply because he was the bearer of bad news. "I am getting old," she realized, "and the daughter I had hoped would soon be strong enough to pull me down is now dead. Who now will do me the honors before I grow erratic and become a hazard to the clan?" The small furry body was hauled away, and a sturdy paha mopped up the bloody mess. The other Pila looked at her. "Let them stare. When we capture the Earthlings, it won't matter. I shall be famous, and this incident will be ignored by all, especially the Pila. If we are the first ones to approach the progenitors with an offering, the law won't matter anymore. The Pila will not simply be our adult liege clients. They will be ours again, to meddle with, to redesign, to shape once more."
"Back to work! All!" She snapped her mating claw. The twang sent the bridge crew scuttling off to their stations, some to repair the smoking damage from a near miss in the most recent battle with the Tandu. "Think now, Sorrow Mother. Can you spare ships to send once more to the planet, to that hellish volcano where every fleet has already sent a party to fight and die? There weren't supposed to be any Gubru left here, but a battered Gubru scout had shown up at the place where the distress call came from. It had gone to smoky ruin along with a Tandu destroyer. Prittle's ship, number 16, and two other vessels, even her battle computers could not identify. Perhaps one was a surviving spear ship of the Brothers of the Night, which had hidden on one of Kithrop's moons. Meanwhile, out here, the final battle with the Tandu's unholy alliance had turned into a bloody draw. The Sorrow still had a slim advantage, so the remaining Thenanin stayed by their Tandu allies. Should she risk all in the next encounter? For the Tandu to win would be horrible. They would, if they gained the power, destroy so many beautiful species that the Sorrow might someday own. If it came down to a choice, she guessed the Thenanin would switch sides one more time.
"Strategy section," she snapped.
"Fleet Mother?"
A paha warrior approached, but stopped just out of arm reach. It eyed her cautiously. Given a chance, she would breed respect into the paha genes so deeply nothing would ever eradicate it. The paha stepped back involuntarily as her claw stretched.
"Find out which ships are now most expendable. Organize them into a small squadron. We're going to investigate the planet again."
The paha saluted and returned to its station quickly. Krat settled deeper into the Vlitor cushion. "We shall need a distraction," she thought. "Perhaps another expedition to that volcano would make the Thenanin nervous and let the Tandu think we know something. Of course," she reminded herself, "the Tandu themselves may know what we do not."
Chapter 59 Krydike.
Far away, they call. The giants, the spirits of ocean, the leviathans. Krydike begins to understand. Does begin
The old gods are part figment, part racial memory, part ghost, and part something else. Something an engineer could never have allowed his ears to hear or eyes to see. Far away, they call. Leviathans. Not yet. Not yet. Not. Krydike has a duty to perform, yet does have a duty. No more. No more an engineer. But Krydike remains a spacer. Not useless. Krydike will do what he can do to help, save his crew, his ship.
Chapter 60 Jillian. She wanted to rub her eyes, but the face mask was in the way. Too much remained to be done. The Finns came and went, swooping by her wherever she traveled in the ship, almost toppling her in their hurry to report and then be off again, carrying out orders. I hope Hikahi gets back soon. I'm not doing badly, I guess, but I'm no starship officer. She has the training to rule a crew. Hikahi doesn't even know she's captain, Jillian thought. Much as I pray they get the line open soon, I'll hate having to break that news to her. She wrote a brief message to Emerson Dianetti, and the last courier dashed off for the engine room. Wattasetti kept pace alongside her as she turned to swim into the outlock. There were two small crowds of dolphins in the bay, one at the forward sally hatch, and the other clustered about the longboat. The bow of the small spaceship almost touched the iris of one of the outer hatches. Its stern disappeared into a metal sheath beyond the rear end of the outlock. When the longboat is gone, this place'll look pretty empty, she thought. A Finn in the party at the lock saw her and sped toward Jillian. He halted abruptly before her and hovered in the water at attention.
Flankers and scouts are ready to depart when you give the word, Jillian.
Thank you, Zaft. It will be soon. Is there still no word from the line repair party? Or from Kipiru?
No, sir. The courier you sent to follow Kipiru should be near the wreck shortly, though.
It was frustrating. Takata Jim had severed the link to the Thenanin wreck, and now it seemed impossible to find the break. For once she cursed the fact that monofilaments could be hidden so well. For all they knew, some terrible disaster might have struck the work party at the very site where she was planning on moving Streaker. At least the detectors indicated the space battle was still going on, almost as fierce as ever. But what was keeping Tom? He was supposed to set off a message bomb when ETs showed up to investigate his ruse. But since the fake distress call, there had been nothing. In addition to everything else, the damn NIS machine wanted to talk to her. It had not set off the hidden alarm in her office to indicate that it was an emergency, but every time she used a comm unit, she heard a faint click that signaled the thing's desire to talk. It was enough to make a femme just want to climb into bed and stay there. A sudden commotion broke out near the lock. The wall speaker let out a brief, sloppy squeal of trinary, followed by a longer report in loose, high-pitched Anglic.
Sir!
Zoft turned excitedly.
They report.
I heard.
She nodded. The line's been repaired. Congratulate the repair team for me, and get them inside for a couple of hours' rest. Then please ask Herkapete to contact Hikahi right away. He's to ascertain her situation and tell her we begin moving the ship at 2100 hours unless she objects. I'll be calling her shortly.
Aye, sir.
Zoft whirled and sped off. Wattasetti watched her silently, waiting.
All right, she said. Let's see Takata Jim and Metz off. You've made certain the crew has offloaded anything not on our checklist and inspected everything the exiles took aboard?
Yes. They haven't even got a flare gun, no radio, and no more fuel than the minimum needed to reach the island.
Jillian had gone on her own inspection of the boat a few hours back, while Metz and Takata Jim were still packing. She had taken a few additional precautions that nobody else knew about.
Who's going with them?
3 volunteers, all of them strange, Stenos. All males. We searched them down to their penile sheaths. They're clean. All in the longboat now, ready to go.
Jillian nodded.
Then, for better or worse, let's get them out of here so we can get on with other things.
Mentally, she had already begun rehearsing what she had to tell Hikahi.
Chapter 61 Hikahi and Suesi.
Remember, she told Tisht and Suesi, maintain radio silence at all cost, and try to keep those crazy Fen in the wreck from eating up all the supplies in the first few days, hmm?
Tisht signaled assent with a jaw clap, although her eyes were heavy with reservation. Suesi said,
Are you sure you won't let one of us come with you?
I'm sure if I encounter disaster, I want no more lives lost. If I find survivors, I might need every bit of room. In any event, the skiff runs itself, essentially. All I have to do is watch it.
You can't fight while piloting, Hannes pointed out.
If I had a gunner along, I might be tempted to fight. This way I have to run away. If Streaker is dead or captured, I must be able to return the skiff to you here, or you'll all be doomed.
Suesi frowned, but found he had to agree with her reasoning.
He was thankful Hikahi had stayed as long as she had, letting them use the skiff's power to finish preparing a habitat inside the wreck.
We're all worried about Streaker and the captain, he thought, but Hikahi must be in agony.
All right, then. Goodbye and good luck, Hikahi. May Ifni's boss watch over you.
The same to both of you.
Hikahi took Suesi's hand gently between her jaws, then did the same with Tisht's left pectoral fin. Tisht and Suesi left through the skiff's small airlock. They backed their sled toward the yawning opening in the sunken alien battleship. A low whine spread from the skiff as power came on. The sound echoed back to them from the mammoth sea cliff that towered over the crash site. The tiny space vessel began to move slowly eastward, picking up speed underwater. Hikahi had chosen a roundabout route, taking her far out before swinging back in an arc to Streaker's hiding place. This would keep her out of touch for as long as a couple of days, but it would also mean that her point of origin could not be traced if an enemy lay in wait where Streaker had been. They watched until the boat disappeared into the gloom. Long after Suesi ceased hearing anything, Tisht waved her jaw slowly back and forth, following the diminishing sound. 2 hours later, as Hannes was lying down for his first nap in his new dry quarters, the makeshift intercom by his pallet squawked.
Not more bad news, he sighed.
Lying in the darkness with one arm over his eyes, he touched the comm.
What? He said simply.
It was Lucky Ka, the young electronics tech and junior pilot. His voice fizzed with excitement.
Sir, Tisht says you should come quickly. It's the ship.
Suesi rolled over onto one elbow.
Streaker?
Yes, the line just reopened. They want to talk to Hikahi right away.
All of the strength went out of Suesi's arms. He slumped back and groaned. Oh, frabjous day. By now she's well out of sonar speak range. At times like these, I wish I'd talk dolphin jabber like Tom Orley. Maybe Trinary could express something properly ironic and vulgar about the way the universe works.
Chapter 62 Exiles. The longboat slid smoothly through the port and out into the twilight blue of Kithrop's ocean.
"You're going the wrong way,"
Ignacio Metz said after the iris closed behind them. Instead of turning east, the boat spiraled upward.
"Just a small detour, Dr. Metz," Takata Jim soothed.
"Sneak-a-Joe! Tell Streaker I'm adjusting the trim."
The dolphin on the co-pilot's ramp began whistling to his counterpart on the ship. The sonar speak squawked back angrily. Streaker also had noticed the change in course. Metz's seat was above and behind Takata Jim's. The water level came up to his waist.
"What are you doing?" he asked.
"Just getting used to the controls."
"Well, watch out. You're headed straight for the detection buoys."
Metz watched, amazed, as the craft sped toward the crew of dolphins, dismantling the listening devices. The work fin scattered out of the way, cursing shrilly as the boat crashed into the tethered buoys. Metal smithereens clattered along its prow and fell into blackness. The sonar speak squawked. Dr. Metz blushed. Good fin persons shouldn't use language like that. Takata Jim seemed oblivious. He calmly turned the small ship around and piloted it at a sedate pace eastward toward their island destination. The longboat drove down a narrow canyon, leaving the brightly lit subsea veil and Streaker behind it.
"Tell them it was an accident,"
Takata Jim told his co-pilot.
"The trim was out of line, but now we've got it under control. We're proceeding underwater to the island as ordered."
"Accident my hairy Uncle Fred scrotum!"
The words were followed by a sniggering laugh from the back of the control room.
"You know, I kind of figured you wouldn't leave without destroying the incriminating evidence first, Takata Jim."
Dr. Metz struggled with his straps to turn around. He stared.
"Charles Dart, what are you doing here?"
Perched on a shelf in a storage locker, whose door was now open, a space-suited chimpanzee grinned back at him.
"Why, exercising a teeny-tiny bit of initiative, Dr. Metz. Now, you be sure and note that in your records. I want to be given credit for it."
He broke into a shrieking giggle, amplified by his suit speaker. Takata Jim twisted about on his ramp to regard the chimp for a moment. He snorted and turned back to his piloting. Charlie visibly screwed up his nerve to slide out of the cabinet into the water, even though none of it could touch him through the spacesuit. He floundered in the liquid up to his helmet ring.
"But how?"
Metz started to ask. Charlie hefted a large, heavy, waterproof sack from the locker to a man seat next to Metz.
"I used deductive reasoning,"
he said as he climbed up.
"I figured Jillian's boys would only be watching out for misbehaving by a few grumbling stenos. So, thought I, why not get to the longboat by a route they wouldn't even think of watching?"
Metz's eyes widened.
"The sleeve? You crawled into one of the sealed maintenance ways that the builders used on Earth, and made your way to the boat's access panels, down by the thrust motors." "Righto!"
Charlie beamed as he buckled his seatbelt.
"You probably had to remove some plates in the sleeve wall using a jack pry. No dolphin could manage such a thing in an enclosed space, so they didn't think of it." "No, they didn't."
Metz looked Charlie up and down.
"You passed pretty close to the thrusters. Did you get cooked?" "My suit rad meter says raw to medium rare."
Charlie mocked, blowing on his fingertips. Metz grinned.
"I shall indeed take note of this rare display of ingenuity, Dr. Dart. And welcome aboard. I'll be too busy anyway inspecting the Kiqui to take proper care of that robot of yours. Now you can do it right."
Dart nodded eagerly.
"That's why I'm here." "Excellent. Perhaps we can have a few games of chess as well."
I'd like that.
They sat back and watched as the ocean ridges passed by. Every few minutes one would look at the other and would burst out laughing. The Stenos were silent.
What's in the sack?
Metz pointed to the large satchel on Dart's lap. Charlie shrugged.
Personal effects, instruments, only the barest, most minuscule, most Spartan necessities.
Metz nodded and settled back again. It would indeed be nice to have the chimpanzee along on the trip. Dolphins were fine people, of course, but mankind's older client race had always struck him as better conversationalists, and dolphins didn't play chess worth a damn. It was an hour later that Metz recalled Charlie's first words on announcing his presence aboard. Just what did the chimp mean when he accused Takata Jim of destroying evidence? That was a very strange thing to say. He put the question to Dart.
Ask the lieutenant, Charlie suggested. He seemed to know what I meant. We're not exactly on speaking terms, he grumbled.
Metz nodded earnestly.
I will ask him as soon as we get settled on the island. I will certainly do that.
Chapter 63. Tom Orley. In the tangled shadows below the weed carpet, he made his way cautiously from air hole to air hole. The face mask helped him stretch a deep breath a long way, especially when he got near the island and had to search for an opening to the shore. Tom finally crawled out onto land just as the orange sun Kisthemene slipped behind a thick bank of clouds to the west. The long Kithrop day would last for a while yet, but he missed the direct warming of the sun's rays. Evaporation chill made him shiver as he pulled himself through a gap in the weeds and up the rocky shoreline. He climbed on his hands and knees to a hummock a few meters above the sea and sat back heavily against the rough basalt. Then he pulled the breathing mask down around his neck. The island seemed to rock slowly, as if it were a cork bobbing in the sea. It would take a while to grow used to solid ground again. Just long enough, he realized ironically, for him to finish what he had to do here and get back into the water again. He pulled clumps of green slime from his shoulders and shivered as the damp slowly evaporated. Hunger. Ah, there was that, too. It took his mind off the damp and chill, at least. He thought about pulling out his last food bar, but decided it could wait. It was all within 1,000 kilometers that he could eat, barring what he might find in alien wreckage. Smoke still rose where the small E.T. scout had crashed, just over the shoulder of the mountain. The thin stream climbed to merge high above with sooty drifts from the volcano's crater. Once in a while, Tom heard the mountain itself growl. Okay, let's move. He gathered his feet beneath him and pushed off. The world wavered unsteadily. Still, he was pleasantly surprised to find himself standing without too much trouble. Maybe Jill's right, he thought. Maybe I have reserves I've never touched before. He turned to his right, took a step, and almost tripped. He recovered, then stumbled along the rocky slope, thankful for his webbed gloves when it came to climbing over jagged rocks, serrated like chipped flint. One step after another, he drew near the source of the smoke. Topping a small rise, he came into view of the wreck. The scout had broken into 3 pieces. The stern section lay submerged, only its torn front end protruding from the charred weeds in the shallows. Tom checked the radiation meter at the rim of his face mask. He could stand the dose for a few days if necessary. The forward half of the wreck had split longitudinally, spilling the contents of the cockpit along a stony strand. Loose banners of fine wire wafted above metal bulkheads, which had been pulled and twisted apart like taffy. Looks easy enough, Tom thought.
I just go down and inspect the damn thing. One step at a time.
He thought about drawing his needler, but decided it would be better to have both hands free in case he fell.
There wasn't much left. Tom poked through the scattered small pieces, recognizing bits of various machines, but nothing told him what he wanted to know, and there was no food. Large bent sheets of metal lay everywhere. Tom approached one that seemed to have cooled off and tried to lift it. It was too heavy to budge more than a few inches before he had to let it drop. Tom panted with his hands on his knees for a moment, breathing heavily. A few meters away was a great pile of driftwood. He went over and pulled out a few of the thicker stumps of dried seaweed. They were tough, but too springy to use as pry bars. Tom scratched his stubble and thought. He looked at the sea, covered all the way to the horizon with vile, slimy vines. Finally, he started gathering dried vines together into two piles. After dark, he sat by a driftwood fire, weaving tough strands of vine into a pair of large, flat fans, somewhat like tennis rackets with loops on one side. He wasn't sure they would work as desired, but tomorrow he would find out. He sang softly in trinary to distract himself from his hunger. The whistled nursery rhyme echoed softly from the nearby cliffside. Hands and fire, use them, to leap higher. Dreams and song, use them, to leap long. Tom stopped suddenly and cocked his head. After a silent moment, he slid his needler out of its holster. Had he heard a sound? Or was it his imagination? He rolled quietly out of the firelight and crouched in the shadows, looking into the darkness, and, like a dolphin, tried to listen to the shape of things. In a stalker's crouch, from cover to cover, he made a slow circuit of the wreckage-strewn beach.
Bar keen klimpf anatan plikeno vahumnipf?
Tom dove behind a hull shard and rolled over, breathing open-mouthed to keep silent. He listened.
Vahumin kintsunpf?
The voice resonated as if from a metal cavity, from under one of the large pieces of wreckage. A survivor? Who would have imagined? Tom called out,
Birkeksklimp, Vahumin idisk, Vithinen klif fif.
He waited. When the voice in the darkness answered, Tom was up and running.
Idatis, Vithinen klif.
He dove once again and fetched up against another shard of metal, then crawled on his elbows and took a quick look around the side of the bulkhead, and aimed his weapon directly into the eyes of a large reptiloid face, only a meter away. The face grimaced in the dim starlight. He had only met Thenanin once, and studied them at the school on Kathrenalin for 1 week. The creature was half squashed under a massive warped metal plate. Tom could guess its expression was one of agony. The scout's arms and back had been broken under the piece of hull.
Vahumin tibarchitpa?
Tom adjusted to the dialect the others spoke, a version of Galactic 6.
Would not kill you, human, had I even the means. I wish only to persuade you to talk to me and distract me for a time.
Tom holstered the needler and moved to sit cross-legged in front of the pilot. It would only be polite to listen to the creature, and be ready to put him out of his misery if he asked the favor. I grieve that I am unable to succor you, Tom answered in Galactic 6. Though you are an enemy, I have never been one to call Thenanin wholly evil. The creature grimaced again, his ridge crest bumped intermittently against the metal roof, and he winced each time.
Nor do we think of human Vlek as totally without promise, though recalcitrant, wild, and irreverent.
Tom bowed, accepting as whole the partial compliment. "I am prepared to do the service of termination, should you wish it," he offered.
"You are kind, but that is not our way. I will wait as my pain balances my life. The great ghosts shall judge me brave."
Tom lowered his gaze. "May they judge you brave." The Thenanin breathed raggedly, eyes closed. Tom's hand drifted to his waistband. He touched the bulge that was the message bomb. "Are they still waiting back at Streaker?" he wondered. "What will Krydike decide to do if he doesn't hear from me? I must know what's been happening in the battle above Kithrib." "For conversation and distraction," he offered, "shall we exchange questions?" The Thenanin opened his eyes. They actually seemed to hold a hint of gratitude.
"Nice. A nice idea. As elder, I shall begin. I will ask simple questions, so as not to strain you."
Tom shrugged. "Almost 300 years we've had the library. We've had 6,000 years of intricate civilization, and still nobody believes humans could be anything but ignorant savages."
"Why did you not from Morgren flee to a safer haven?"
the scout asked.
"Earth could not protect you, nor even those scoundrel Timbrimi who lead you into evil ways. But the abdicators are strong. You would have found safety with us. Why did you not come into our arms?"
He made it all sound so simple. If only it were so. If only there had been a truly powerful alignment to flee to, one that would have not charged in return more than Streaker's crew or Earth could afford to pay. How to tell the Thenanin that his abdicators were only slightly less unpalatable than most of the other fanatics? "It is our policy never to surrender to bullying threats," Tom said. "Never. Our history tells us the value of this tradition more than those brought up on the library annals could imagine. Our discovery will be given only to the Galactic Institutes, and only by our Terrigan's Council leaders themselves." At mention of Streaker's discovery, the Thenanin's face showed unmistakable interest, but he waited his turn, allowing Tom the next question. "Are the Thenanin victorious overhead?" Tom asked anxiously. "I saw Tandu. Who prevails in the sky?" Air whistled through the pilot's breathing vents.
"The glorious fail. The killer Tandu thrive, and sorrow pagans abound. We harass where we can, but the glorious have failed. Heretics shall gain the prize."
It was a bit of a tactless way to put it, with one of the prizes sitting in front of him. Tom cursed softly. What was he going to do? Some of the Thenanin survived, but could he tell Krydike to go ahead and take off on that basis? Should they try a ruse which, even if successful, would gain them allies too weak to do any good? The Thenanin breathed raggedly. Although it was not his turn, Tom asked the next question. "Are you cold? I will move my fire here. Also, there is work I must do as we talk. Forgive this junior patron if I offend." The Thenanin looked at him with purple, cat-irised eyes.
"Politely spoken. We are told you humans are without manners. Perhaps you are merely unlearned, yet well-meaning."
The scout wheezed and blew sand grains from his breathing slits, while Tom quickly moved his camp. By the flickering flame light, the Thenanin sighed.
"It is appropriate that, trapped and dying on a primitive world, I shall be warmed by the crafty fire-making skills of a wolfling. I shall ask you to tell a death-bound being about your discovery. No secrets, just a story. A story about the miracle of the Great Return."
Tom drew forth the memory, one that still gave him chills.
"Consider ships," he began. "Think of starships, ancient, pitted, and great as moons."
This ends side 2 of cassette 8.